I'm not going to sing this, but I can see for miles and miles.
What can you see?
Planes everywhere. You may remember in episode 2 of this fair show, I talked about a bit of software that I'd installed on a Raspberry Pi to track the airplanes floating in the sky around and about Popey Towers. And this gave me a free business account on Flight Radar. And that was all good and everything. And then as soon as I mention it, I get DMs from people and people messaging us in the community suggesting ways to improve what I've done. And I've had it installed for over a year and it's been sat there quite happily looking something like 70 nautical miles into the distance and seeing lots of planes flying around. And the suggestions that I got from various people, I did mention in episode 2 that I only sent to Flight Radar and I'd quite like to send to other places, but I don't know where to send to, right? Mm-hmm. And I started getting suggestions from people of where to send my flight data to. And it turns out it's really easy to do. There's a couple of places that I'm sending it to. There was apparently some drama in the past around something called ADSB Exchange. I think that's what it was called. And something happened. I don't know the details. I'm sure you can dig it up. But a bunch of other independent ADSB data collection services popped up in the aftermath. And one of them is called ADSB 1, O-N-E, and one of them is called ADSB.fi. And they're both basically identical. There's a bit of software. You clone the software and you run a command and it installs it and it starts sending data to the website. That's it. Job done. It's really easy.
So these two exchanges, are they like proxies to send data to multiple services?
No, they are multiple services.
Right.
There are a bunch of these, and those are the two that I happen to be suggested to use. And you just send data to them. They're basically identical. I'm sure there may be, you know, communities built around them that would say, no, we are the People's Popular Front of Judea or whatever. But they're basically the same. I send data to both of them, and there's a map, and I can see the planes that my little antenna can see. Mm-hmm. And so that's good.
And your data still goes to Flight Radar 24 as well?
Yes. So I still get my business account.
Okay.
And the other interesting thing is, at the end of the little script that does the install for both of these, ADSB 1 and ADSB FI, they have a little extra thing that says, do you want to install a web viewer? And if you say yes, then it adds a web page that you can go to on the Pi locally, not online. And it shows you a map of the area with a plot of where all the planes are in different colors, and you can click on them and see where, you know, what altitude they're at and what direction they're flying in, and all the data it has. It's very pretty and, you know, functional. And they're both very similar in that regard, and they both show you the same kind of thing. So you really only need one of them. But I happen to have them both installed until I realized they're both showing me identical data because it is the same data they're both sending. And then the other thing someone suggested I should do was add an amplifier. An antenna amplifier. And the person who suggested this was our very own friend, Phelim. So I ordered one from Pi Hut. And sure enough, I put it in line with the antenna with a little adapter. And it certainly helped. It certainly made the range a bit wider. And then the other suggestion was you should put it in the loft, because having it in your bedroom, north facing, the southern part of the house is blocking, you know, some of this signal. So I did, and I got some cable ties. I went out there in the hottest day of the year so far, which was the dumbest thing to do. And I put it all up there, and it certainly does see farther now. Wow. So with the combination of the amplifier and raising its altitude by, I don't know, 10, 15 feet higher, where I was seeing a distance of about 70 nautical miles, I can easily see 120, 130 nautical miles. So I can see planes as far from where my house is. If you want to look at this on a map, Farnborough in Hampshire, I can see as far as Leeds, which is quite far north of here, which surprised me a bit.
That took us a long time to drive there when we went to Ogham.
It did. And I can see all the way into Wales, and I can see quite far south down into the English Channel. So, you know, for the kind of person who likes numbers and stats and internet points, it's good. And it was not super expensive. It was completely free for me to add these additional exchanges to send my data to, and the amplifier didn't cost very much. The only one other thing I did was I moved it from a Pi 3 to a Pi 4. Because I managed to get hold of a Pi 4 with 8 gig of RAM.
Wow.
And yeah, so that's now in the loft, this Pi 4. It's getting a bit warm. So I think I might put a little fan on it or something. Because
right.
It's quite warm at this time of year. But yeah, I'm really pleased with this. It's improved. There's a lovely community of people out there who want to help you. There's a little Discord for the ADS-B exchanges, and everyone's like a little bit competitive and suggesting antennas and improvements you can make, and it's all very lovely. I really enjoy it. It's a nice little community.
And is the radius of your sort of visibility equal, or does it favour a particular direction? And how's that radius changed as a result of the changes you've made?
That's a great question. And previously, the radius was quite spiky in certain directions, and you could tell that there was a kind of cutout, like a Pac-Man-shaped cutout in the radius, which was like my wall,
right,
where it couldn't really see much in that direction. But also, you've got to remember, you know, there are flight paths and channels that planes fly along. And so there are certain, if it's not quite a circle, it's quite zigzaggy at certain directions, because, you know, planes fly in particular directions when they're going to the US, or they're going down to Europe or across to Europe or something like that. So it's a bit zigzaggy. And there are certainly bits southwest of me which are not very populated. And I don't know if that's because planes don't go southwest because they'd end up in the Atlantic, or whether it's partly because there might be a bit of a hill to the southwest of me.
Right.
I'm in a little bit of a dip. It's all super fascinating, and it's really easy to set up, really easy to use. The little script just worked. You know, it was apt install some stuff, git clone a thing, run a script. It all just worked, and all the people are lovely. And I'm very happy with this. And I can see myself buying a much bigger aerial. And I can see myself trying to convince the wife to let me strap it to the side of the chimney.
Your kids are going to come home from university and their bedroom's been turned into some sort of communications room.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So yeah, I'm very happy, and I highly recommend everyone else does the same thing.
I hacked my washing machine.
Ooh, you're a black hat hacker, or is it white cottons only?
Well, the next thing that I tell you is going to seem unrelated, but stick with it. I recently got a new car.
Okay.
And it's an electric car, which means I also changed my energy tariff so that I get a cheaper rate overnight for charging the car, which works fine. Much cheaper than putting diesel in my old car anyway. But that got me thinking, well, if I've got this cheap rate overnight, what other energy usage can I shift from the daytime to the nighttime and do it on the cheaper rate? And I sort of got looking at the things. There's a few things that run all the time, which, you know, good, they'll be cheaper running overnight. Most things that we do during the day. But then there's a couple of things which we do every day, which were good candidates, which are the washing machine and the dishwasher. Dishwasher, fairly easy, because it doesn't matter when the dishwasher finishes, as long as it finishes before we need to use the stuff. And it's got a built-in time delay, which is handy.
Oh, that's helpful. Nice.
Yeah, exactly. I turn that on in the evening and say, come on in 3 hours. And, you know, it comes on once it's changed to the lower rate. Washing machine isn't so easy because it's a bargain basement model. It doesn't have a time delay. And I don't want to stay up until 11:30 every night, put it on, and then it finishes at like just after like 1 o'clock and sits there damp all night. And I've got smelly clothes in the morning. So I was a bit disappointed I wouldn't be able to do that. But then I thought, well, I wonder if anyone else has thought about this. So I did a bit of research online to see if there was a way of sort of retrofitting a timer. And someone said on some forum, oh, you just plug it into a socket timer and it'll come back on and pick up where it left off. And I thought, well, that's not going to work, because when it turns off, it's going to reset and then it'll come on and it'll need me to set it up again. How wrong was I? So it turns out you can literally do this. You set up a socket timer. I happen to have a mechanical timer sitting around, which I used to use for a slow cooker. you set it up for when you want it to come on, you plug it in, you plug your machine in, and then you switch the switch on the timer so that it's always on. You load your machine, you set your machine, you turn it on, and then once the door locks, you switch the switch on the timer back so it's on timer mode. Your machine turns off, and then when the timer comes on, your machine wakes up and says, oh, I've got a program running. And then it just carries on and washes your clothes.
Nice.
And I had literally no idea that this would work, except for some rando on the internet saying, oh, you can do this.
Would it be fair to say that the control knob, the big dialy thing, I assume it has a big dialy thing, the washing machine, not the timer.
Yes.
Does it click? Is it like a rotary, like clockworky type thing?
It's got to click to the dial, but it's got all sort of touch buttons. It's not like, yeah, it's not like you've set physically set a switch for it to go. It's not that old.
Right.
But it is quite, you know, a fairly cheap model.
Does it have a mangle and a tub?
No, but yeah, it has a flashy button that beeps and doesn't click in when you say go, which is why I assumed that as soon as you turn it off, it forgets everything it does.
I feel a little bit robbed after your opening statement. I thought you were going to tell us about how you'd found the REST API to your washing machine and you'd found it was running an old version of Nginx and you'd use some buffer overflow exploit and you'd put your own custom firmware on the washing machine. But no, sorry, I don't think
it might be false advertising to talk about it here. I don't think my washing machine is running Linux at the moment. Well, you know, now I've got the taste for it. Who knows where this might end up?
I am interested to hear if any of our listeners have hacked their white goods in their kitchen. Or, sorry, I know it's a weird thing in the UK that we put the washing machine in the kitchen and everyone else thinks we're weird. Your white goods, wherever they may reside,
yeah,
to do this kind of stuff.
I'd also be interested if anyone can explain to me why it is that this works, because I guess it must have either some non-volatile storage or a battery backup in case of power cuts or something, which is designed to, I imagine it's not designed to be used for this. I imagine the reason it can do it is because if it loses power.
No, it must be, right? Because it's such a sort of clockwork solution. It could have only evolved because these old, you know, timers, which we've got them around the house, you know, from when we used to go on holiday, you know, and I've been on my hands and knees in the front room searching out what I thought was a mouse in the front room at one point. And it wasn't. It was a squeaky timer we got in there that was squeaking as it was winding down. But it makes me think that, you know, as a home appliance, maybe this was something that was sort of baked into the design of these things years ago, because that was the way you would have automated them. Mm.
I have to say, I was equally incredulous at your rather limp hacking definition. And so the way to redeem this is you need to go and get the manufacturer's circuit diagram or take it apart and discover whether it certainly has a battery backup or some kind of non-volatile memory. I look forward to a subsequent episode where you clarify this.
I entered Linux Game Jam 2023 in a not very Linuxy way.
Oh, did you get disqualified?
I don't think I've been. In fact, I know I haven't been disqualified because my entry has now been assessed by the judges. So now I wasn't disqualified, but it was an unusual choice.
And what was your choice?
Well, back in 2019, you will remember that the three of us did a coding challenge where we each created a, in air quotes, game using Bash.
How dare you?
Slightly more air quotes used for some of our games than others.
For exhibition at Fostalk Live, which was a live show that Joe Ressington used to host in the basement of a pub in London. And this was our big extravaganza that year. And the game that I made that year was called Ansi Alien Attack, and it was my effort at making a bullet hell shoot 'em up in Bash. And, well, Alan Nerd sniped me because he told me the Linux Game Jam was coming up about a month ago, and I was like, I think I might have a go at this. And without any other ideas, I thought back to the challenge that we did in 2019. And I thought, you know what? That game that I tried to make in Bash, it really deserves like a proper implementation.
A remaster.
Yes, exactly. So I dusted off the idea and I re-implemented it in something a bit more modern.
So full 3D graphics?
Yeah, HD.
You'd like to think that, wouldn't you? But no, I only elevated the technology level ever so slightly. I used something called Pico 8. So those of you that have ever played like retro games, emulation and what have you, Pico 8 is effectively like an emulator for like an 8-bit console that never existed. It's a fantasy console, and it's very much sort of an 8-bit, sort of at that crossover between the 8-bit and 16-bit era. So I use that, and it's an emulator, sort of, but it's also got like a development environment embedded into it. So there's an IDE and a sprite editor and a sound editor and a music composition tool.
You're being very generous calling it an IDE. Really?
Well,
I mean, I guess it is, you know, you type code and you run it.
Yeah.
So is that the minimum requirement for an IDE, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is. It's a bare bones IDE. And what I quite like about it is the font is absolutely massive. So I can see it when I've forgotten my glasses or can't find my glasses, which was quite handy.
Is this just because it's very low resolution, pixelated, and you have a big screen?
Yes. So the resolution of Pico 8 is 128 by 128 pixels. So consequently, when it's scaled up, each character in the editor is about 2 centimeters squared.
Right.
So the Pico 8 choice was the not very Linuxy thing. Because in the past, I've used something like Godot, which is an open source game engine, to do these sorts of things. But I wanted to try Pico 8 because quite often you'll see people using Pico 8 in game jams, particularly game jams that are very time compressed, because of its constraints, you can work really quickly with it. The sprites are only 8x8 pixels. So if you want to draw sprites, you don't have to be a good sprite designer, and it's very easy to make sprites, so game developers use them in jams.
And it's all integrated anyway, so it's not like you need to go and assemble like 5 different tools and utilities to do it, and you don't have to switch between them. You press a function key and you're in the sprite editor, press a function key, you're in the editor.
Yeah.
Done. It's very elegant.
You put a sprite on the screen, you control R, you're now running your game. You know, it's really fast to work with. And the main reason I wanted to try Pico 8 is when I was doing my last game jam, I made a platformer. And during that jam, I researched some other modern platformers to learn like how to make a platformer. And Celeste was obviously something that I looked at. And I discovered that Celeste was originally a proof of concept that was developed using Pico 8 during a 4-day game jam. And that original version of Celeste kind of propelled Pico 8 to popularity. It was the thing that has... And now if you go and look in the Pico 8 community, you will find endless remixes and adaptations of that version of Celeste. So having learned this thing existed and having heard that you can go quickly, I thought, right, it's a game jam. I'll use this thing because I can move fast. And it was a 10-day game jam, which is quite long, but I have limited time to sort of squeeze things in. So I thought it would be a good fit. And I absolutely loved using it. It was really good fun.
And you say it's not very Linuxy. Presumably, as this is a Linux game jam, it does run on Linux.
Yes. So Pico 8 itself runs on Linux, macOS and Windows and Raspberry Pi, both 32-bit and 64-bit Raspberry Pi. And what's rather impressive is its export facility. So make me a build of my game will export native binaries for all of those things, regardless of which platform you're on. And it only takes a few seconds. So you can script this and in a matter of seconds, you have a Mac build, a Linux build, a Windows build, and Raspberry Pi 32-bit and 64-bit native builds. It also will spit out an HTML5 build, a WebAssembly build, and I think I'm missing one as well. So for the purposes of entering a game jam, it's absolutely brilliant because it's really minimal, very quick to test, and you can push out versions for everything that you'd want to run it on.
Nice. And Pico 8 is constrained in terms of resolution. It's also constrained in other ways as well. There's a limit to like how big your game can be as well, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So the way that Pico 8 games are shared around in the Pico 8 community, they call them carts, as if it was a cartridge that you might have for like a Nintendo Entertainment System. But those cart images are actually PNG files. A PNG file of the cover image that looks like a cartridge, and that includes the compressed game code and all of your assets. And that compressed game code can only be 32K. So there's sort of these artificial constraints to sort of put you in that 8-bit mode where every bit matters. And then to sort of further enforce that on the programmer, you can only use 8,192 tokens in your program. And a token is X equals one, that's three tokens. So, you know, it gives you an idea, you know, there are some tricks about how you can maximize the way tokens are allocated, but you have to think in a very sort of efficient way. And that was a problem as it happened, because it was a 10-day jam, and you can hit the token limit within 10 days, and that starts to hamper what you can do. If you were just doing a jam that's a few hours or a couple of days, I think you could program freely without thinking about these constraints, and you'd be fine. But when you're doing a larger project or you've got more time, I think you can exhaust the tokens before the time of the jam.
We did follow along with your escapades and tested out the game as it went along. And there were quite a few occasions where you would, you know, make a bold statement about, okay, I need to go and find some more tokens, as if you were like scrabbling around for 10 pences in the output of a cigarette machine or something. You know,
it was a bit like that.
Right. Yeah. And that seemed to slow you down a little bit at times.
Yeah, so the last 4 days, there were things that I hadn't made for the game, and there were things that I wanted to add, and I was limited by tokens, and I spent almost all of a Saturday just optimizing the code to claim back 150 tokens so that I could make the end of level boss, for example.
Wow. So would you use Pico 8 again if there was another game jam? Because, like, you've surpassed what I think Bash can do, I think. And then now you've really got into your stride with Pico 8. Would you do another one with Pico 8, or would you maybe stretch your legs even further and re-implement it in some other language or tool?
So I think that's a really good question. I can see myself using Pico 8, and I'll tell you for why. So one of the big things I learned about Pico 8 is that the language that Pico 8 uses is a subset of Lua. Mm. And I'd never used Lua prior to this jam. And it turns out I really like Lua.
It's good, isn't it?
It really agrees with me. Yeah, it's excellent, actually. For this sort of thing, it's brilliant. So you can go quickly with Lua and you can do complex stuff without complicated code, which I really like. So yes, you could prototype stuff, and I can totally see this as a prototyping tool to try out an idea really quickly, because you can have stuff running in a matter of seconds. So yes, but also my daughter has been using Scratch for several years and has really excelled at Scratch. And now she's learning Python at school, but she doesn't have that immediacy of getting interesting things happening on the screen with Python. But with Pico 8, you really can. And actually, Lua is a really great language, I think, to teach sort of new programmers. So I'm going to be using Pico 8 as sort of a learning tool with my daughter to help her further develop her skills. And I suppose the second part of your question is, while I can totally see myself using Pico 8 on a short jam, maybe a 1 or 2 day jam or one of those 3 hour jams that I know you're interested in participating in, Alan, I would use it for that. But because I've now discovered Lua, it's got me researching other game engines that use Lua as the scripting language. And I'm looking now very seriously at a couple of other game engines for sort of more comprehensive game ideas.
The nice thing about Lua is it's well established. It's been used by a lot of people for a lot of different things, like in-game scripting engines and so on. And there are other game development tools, like the one I've used a lot is Love 2D, mm-hmm. which is built upon Lua. And it means there's a ton of documentation out there, and you can search for, you know, how to do this in Lua, how to do that in Lua. And it's quite a basic language. There's not a lot to it, and you can learn it pretty quickly. It's not super complicated. It is, I think it is a good choice. And I think you could build educational materials for kids, and they could pick up Lua just as easy as they pick up Python, if not easier.
Yeah, I think it's easier because there is, Python has the whole, it has to be space and tab indented, and it has to follow a system. And that's difficult to explain to a new programmer. It's frustrating for new programmers, actually. And Lua doesn't have that restriction. And also, as you say, there's lots of good Lua examples out there, and they're almost directly applicable in Pico 8. So if you find something interesting in Lua, you can apply it directly in Pico. And I think that the developers of Pico 8 must be aware of this, because they've recently created this educational version of Pico 8, which is a web-only version. So you don't have to download and install anything. You can just go to the website and you can just code up programs in the same way you use Scratch now.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's very good.
Yeah.
So what are your big takeaways from this?
My biggest takeaways are, if you enter a Linux game jam, it's probably better to choose something that's a little bit more native, because I had to adapt the way Pico 8 behaved for the Linux build so it felt like a native thing, as opposed to like a console from the 1980s. And to sort of make the most of it being a Linux game jam, I did the packaging for lots of different stuff. So I did app images and snaps and debs and Nix flakes and all the rest of it. It spits out tarballs, but I turned those tarballs into proper packages, in air quotes.
The build of the game, does that include the engine as well? Or do you need the quote-unquote Pico 8 emulator as well as a separate thing?
No, when you do an export of the game, that is a complete runtime. So it includes the runtime. But one of our testers, so we have a little group behind the scenes, we have a little group of friends that talk and test games together. And McPhail, who's in that group, he's got a PlayStation Vita, and he was testing ANSI Alien Attack Pico on his PlayStation Vita. And that uses something called Fake 08, which is an emulator for Pico 8, because Pico 8 itself is proprietary. And Fake 08 is an open source implementation of the runtime, and it's not 100% compatible. So the first day of the jam, I spent making my code Fake 08 compatible, because I'd created some text rendering routines and they didn't work.
It is amusing that there is a open source re-implementation of a non-existent console.
Yeah. It's a little bit bonkers. So doing all of that packaging for Linuxy stuff, in the future, I wouldn't bother. I didn't bother with Flatpak this time because I didn't have enough time to learn it. I did make a snap and put it in the Snap Store, but that feels uncomfortable alongside the way you do sort of modern day development with GitHub workflows and actions and things like that. So I wouldn't bother with doing a snap again in the future for a game jam. It's sort of cost prohibitive in terms of time, and it doesn't really fit in with the general flow. But the thing, the main thing I learned is I love Pico 8. I do love Pico 8, but I really love Lua. And I have rediscovered a passion for writing games. The thought process behind creating a game is very different from systems engineering, which is the sort of stuff I do day to day. So I'm going to be doing more game development, and I'm going to be using Lua. And I'm intending to find myself a forever game engine built on Lua.
Nice. So when does the results of the game jam get announced? Do we find out if you get a gold star or wooden spoon of failure?
As we record this, I think there are 2 weeks left in the sort of submissions of the people that took part in the jam can play everyone's games and provide their feedback and reviews and ratings and all the rest of it. And it's really designed to be a, this is what was good, this is where it could be improved. But because of the way itch ratings and reviews in jams work, you do sort of get like a results table.
Leaderboard.
Yes, exactly. So it'll be a couple of weeks before I have all of that feedback. But the organizer has reviewed my game and they enjoyed it. They played it twice. They managed to complete the game on their second time
through.
That's
better than I've done.
It takes about 20 minutes to play. So from start to finish, it takes about 20 minutes. It's about 16 different types of variation on the shoot 'em up idea. Some of the levels, there is no shooting at all. I thought this will be interesting.
I really liked that, actually. I thought it was a really nice sort of mixing it up, just suddenly, oh, you're just concentrating on flying. So it's not just, because, you know, a lot of it is you hold fire and you wiggle back and forth to make sure you hit everything. But suddenly it's like, no, you've just got to bash into stuff with your shields, or you've got to avoid hitting everything. And it, yeah, I quite liked that.
I'm glad you enjoyed that. I discovered these sort of game modes by accident. So as I was writing the game, when the aliens didn't move and they didn't fire, and I was writing the collision detection, I was just sort of whizzing around the screen, colliding into objects. And I thought to myself, there's a game here just doing that. And that became the mini game Power Spree, where you have to collect things that are whizzing around the screen at you. And again, whilst I couldn't fire and the aliens were moving at that point, I thought there's a game here as well without firing, just avoiding them. And that became the sort of asteroids dodging, which you're suddenly propelled into hyperspeed and the weapons go offline and you have to weave in amongst dozens of asteroids, you know, tumbling toward you.
So I imagine we'll put a link in the show notes to your itch.io page. I guess that's the easiest place.
Yeah, that'll be the best place to go. So we'll stick a link to that in the show notes. And if you want to play, it's free to play. It's the source code is MIT licensed. The assets are Creative Commons. All of that is on GitHub, and that's linked from the itch page. So we'll put a link to the itch page in the show notes, and you can have a play.